Well, our study at this time is again in the book of Nehemiah. We're now at Nehemiah, ready to begin the 10th chapter. The setting for this study is the time in which Nehemiah returned to Jerusalem and rebuilt the walls of the city and reestablished the worship of the temple and the function of the city and provinces surrounding Jerusalem. At this time, they have just finished the construction of the wall, and they have given a very brief summary of the history of the Israelites, naming many of the great sins and fallacies of the people, and how that God showed mercy to them, and how that they again turned from God, repeating this over and over again, until finally they had arrived at a position in which they had no country, had no king, and were now being given another chance by God to start over again at Jerusalem. And as they make this great confession, an acknowledgement of the past deeds of the people, they are making a covenant. The last verse of chapter 9 says, "And because of all this, we make a sure covenant and write it, and our princes, Levites, and priests seal unto it." So they're making a covenant now to God that they were going to resolve that they would serve God, that they would follow the law of Moses. They were signing their signature to it. The princes, the priests, and the Levites were sealing unto it. And so as we begin then the 10th chapter, he begins by naming those that sealed, or those that signed this covenant. Now those that sealed were, and these names, this list, this roster of the people who sealed this covenant, go down through the 27th verse, and we're not going to take the time and effort to read through each one of these names. But let us just say this about it. There are four classes of people that are named here. The first class, of course, consisted of Nehemiah, who was the governor, and verse 1. And then we have from verses 2 through 8, the priests named, and there were 22 priests. Then verses 9 through 13 named the Levites, and there were 17 Levites named. And then verses 14 through 27 name the chiefs of the people, and there are 44 of these that are named here. So these verses are taken up with that roster of those who seal the covenant. Then beginning with verse 28, "And the rest of the people, the priests, the Levites, the porters, the singers, the Nethinims, and all they that had separated themselves from the people of the lands under the law of God, their wives, their sons, and their daughters, everyone having knowledge and having understanding, they clave to their brethren." Now, so everybody who is not named in this list, then, he includes them in this category in verses 28 and 29. He says, "The rest of the people." That would be any common person then. The priests, the Levites, the porters, the singers, the Nethinims, and all they that had separated themselves from the people of the lands under the law of God. Now he names this as being a qualification of those who were backing or supporting this covenant. They had separated themselves from the people of the lands. Now, you can't live in a vacuum. Whenever you remove yourself from one situation or environment, you have to, at the same time, put yourself into another environment, because we do not live in vacuums. We're living in some kind of a positive format at all times. So they separate themselves from the people of the lands unto the law of God. That's what they replaced themselves with. They replaced them, their former manner, with the law of God. And this is a great, great lesson for us today. We must separate ourselves from the people of the land. That is, we cannot allow the ways and the traditions, the thoughts and ideals and the mores and the principles of the people of the land to govern our lives. We have to separate ourselves from them and let ourselves be governed by the law of God. Now, he further says, their wives, their sons, and their daughters. It's not just a matter of one member of the household now doing this. The whole family was involved, the wives, the sons, and the daughters. Then he further qualifies this by saying, everyone having knowledge and having understanding. It seems that even back then, and we've followed this principle for a long time in the church, even back then, those that joined themselves to this covenant to now follow God, to now make a decision, we're gonna separate ourselves out of the ways of the world, we're going to start to follow in God, they were those who had understanding and who had knowledge. Now, knowledge is to know the facts. Understanding is to be able to give a proper application of those facts. Now, up until the captivity, it seems that a person was just born into the Jewish nation. He was born into it, and he received the benefits automatically as a result of birthright. But now we have a distinction given here involving those who have knowledge and understanding. The men, the wives, the sons, and the daughters. And this is a very, very important thing to be able to have knowledge and understand. We cannot serve God if we do not have knowledge and understand. That's just all there is to it. We cannot serve God. That is a flat out and out statement that the New Testament repeatedly backs up. And here again, we have it taught even in the time of Nehemiah. Now, what did they do, these people? They clave to their brethren, their nobles, and entered into a curse and into an oath to walk in God's law. Now, to clave to their brethren means that they stood by or stood with or agreed to follow along with this covenant that was formulated by the brethren. They clave with their brethren, their nobles, and entered into a curse and into an oath. Now, as I understand it, they entered into an oath to follow this. Even those who hadn't sealed it, those who hadn't signed it, they entered into an oath to follow this covenant, which would be bound by a curse. That is, if they failed to follow the oath, then they would have the curse to come upon them. And the oath was, the covenant was, to walk in God's law. Now, that seemed like a real simple thing, real simple resolve, but nevertheless, it is the thing that all of our eternal destiny hinges upon. That one little thing there is to walk in God's law. Now, we're going to be walking in some law, whether we like it or not. The law of the devil, the law of the world, or the law of God. They resolved to walk in God's law. Now, what law was that? Which was given by Moses, the servant of God. Very simple. They weren't looking for any new law. They weren't making a new law. They weren't revising or changing the law. They were getting back to the law that applied to them in that day and age, and it was the law of Moses, which was given by Moses, the servant of God, and to observe and to do all the commandments of the Lord our Lord and His judgments and His statutes. Now, that's what it means to walk in the law of God, is to observe and do all the commandments and His judgments and His statutes. Every article of faith, everything that was said for them to do or to not to do, they were going to do it if they walked in this law. And you know, we learned studied about the fact last time that if you keep this law, you live in it. It becomes a part of you. And then they give some more particulars, and these are some of the things that they were really guilty of in recent years. Verse 30, and that we would not give our daughters unto the people of the land, nor take their daughters for our sons. Now, this also was a part of the agreement. They agreed that they would not let their children marry non-believers. That's what it amounts to. And this was the great, great beginning of their downfall as a nation. And even when they came back to rebuild the city, they had again fallen into the same great fallacy, and they had to get rid of those wives, even the children that they had by the wives, and start over now fresh. That's what God insisted that they do. And so now part of this great covenant that they make is that we will not give our daughters to the people of the land, nor take their daughters for our sons. The reason for this is several reasons. One is it dilutes their belief in the true God. They have to then compromise with this person that they're married to. They have to let their children compromise. Their children will, in many cases, now there are exceptions, but in many cases their children are going to believe what the non-believing father or mother believes if they have any influence at all upon them. And so you can see what a great inconsistency that is. And if the people of the land bring ware or any victuals on the Sabbath day to sell, that we would not buy it of them on the Sabbath or on the holy day. Now here is another thing. If the people of the land, that is the people who were not Israelites, they were not children of God, if they should bring their wares or their victuals to sell on the Sabbath day, these people of God agreed not to buy it on the Sabbath day. Said, we will not buy it of them on the Sabbath or on the holy day. So they will not have enough even commercial interest with the outside people to in any way violate the command of God. Now, these people didn't care about the Sabbath day. These people of the land, these Canaanites or Jebusites or whatever their nationality might be, they were interspersed here among the people also. Even though they'd come back to rebuild Jerusalem and repopulate these cities, the people of the land still lived there. They carried on the business as usual. They didn't think any more about the true and living God than they'd ever thought about, and they didn't care about the Sabbath. So when it came time to keep the Sabbath, and they weren't to buy and sell, and they weren't to carry on the everyday activities of the business world, these people went on as usual. They'd bring their wares up there to sell. They'd bring their victuals or food to sell. And the children of Israel were not to patronize them on the Sabbath day. Now, the same is true of us today. We have certain scruples today about obeying God, and the people of the land care nothing about this. They're going to go on with business as usual. When we've appointed time for us to meet together and to worship God, the people of the land could care less about that. They're going to do what they want to do. If they want to have a meeting on a night that we've set aside to study the Bible, they set a meeting for Wednesday night. Doesn't matter to them. They could care less. If they want to have a big gathering like a game, a football game or baseball game, it doesn't matter to them whether it's Sunday morning, Sunday night, or Sunday afternoon. It doesn't matter to them. They want the people to forsake what they're doing in the way of worshiping God and follow after their commercialized endeavors. And so then we have to be the ones who set the standards. We can't let them set the standards for us. We have to set the standards. A few weeks ago, there was a medical meeting near here that I could have gone to. I was invited to it. And it was on a Sunday, all day Sunday. And the next day, one of the doctors asked why I didn't go, and I said, well, first of all, I don't go to things like that on Sunday when I have to miss church. I'm not going to miss church for that at all. And so that just ruled out any other further consideration of it. But the people of the world have no consideration for that. They do not care about that. And so we have to set our standards just as they did then. And it seems they must have had a problem in this area, or he would not have named it. That on the Sabbath day, when they come up here to sell these things, which would violate our Sabbath, we're not going to buy it from them. Now, if they were depending upon the Jewish people for the success of their endeavor on that day, and they didn't buy it from them, after a while they decided they weren't going to go to the trouble of trying to sell on the Sabbath. But if they bought from them and encouraged them to keep on selling at that time, then you can see how that it would just perpetuate the problem. So that was one thing then that they named in verse 31. Then another thing, and that we would leave the seventh year and the exaction of every debt. Now this seventh year is an interesting thing. This rule about this is found in Exodus, the 23rd chapter, verses 10 and 11. We won't turn and read it, but let's just talk about it for a minute. Every seventh year the land was supposed to lie fallow. It was not to be cultivated or used for any commercial purpose. The things that grew on the land spontaneously that year were to be left for the poor to gather or the sojourner to gather and use. And they would make enough crop on the sixth year to carry them through that seventh year until they could make another crop on the eighth year. Every seventh year, which would be 50 years, was the year of Jubilee. Now, on that seventh year, which had been the 49th year, they didn't plan on that year. Then the next year, the year of Jubilee, the 50th year, they didn't plan on that year either. So that time they had 2 years in a row that they didn't plant or cultivate the land. And on the year of Jubilee, the land automatically went back to its original owner. Whichever family or tribe originally owned this land, at the end of 50 years, it went back to them. So any sale of land actually amounted to a lease that was good until the time of the year of Jubilee. So if you bought a piece of land on, say, the 47th year, you only got to keep it 3 years. And it went back to the original owner. And this way, the original disbursement of the land that went out to the tribes and the individual families, that remained in a rather constant condition, because each 50th year the land went back to its original owner, which is a very ingenious way of allowing then the wealth and the property and the land to be properly distributed over a long period of time. It did not accumulate into one little group of people owning all the land. It couldn't happen that way because every 50th year it went back. Another thing on this year of Jubilee, the 50th year, and they mention it here, is that they, well, this happened every seventh year too. They no longer held any debts that were due at that time. So the debts were canceled on that seventh year. So it's a wonderful rule, I think, for a group of people who are following after the commands of God. Verse 32, also we made ordinances for us to charge ourselves yearly with a third part of a shekel for the service of the house of our God. Now here was a rule that we read about in Exodus 30, verses 11 through 16, about this paying part of a shekel for the service of the house of our God. This went for the upkeep of the temple and the service having to do with the temple. Now this is an interesting thing in a way to me. A shekel was a unit of weight, one of the earliest units of weight that we have record of used by God's people, and they probably got it from the Babylonians. It weighed about 4/10 of an ounce, and there are various weights that can be used for a shekel, but it averages out about 4/10 of an ounce. It also was later used to be a unit of money, which is about 64 cents. And originally, this rule in Exodus 30 says that they were to pay half a shekel. That was the law, half a shekel. But it's very interesting here to note that they made the ordinance to read that they would pay a third of a shekel. Now, there's a question as to why they changed it to a third of a shekel. And about the only thing I can think of is because of the hardness of the times, because of the difficulty for them to be as affluent financial-wise as maybe the God's people had been in earlier times, they changed it to a third of a shekel. Because some authorities say, and I have not been able to find the reasoning for their saying this, I just haven't researched it enough, some authorities say that it's very evident that in the times of Christ that they had gone back to the half shekel. So if that be true, they originally had a half shekel. Here they changed it for a temporary time to a third of a shekel. Then it finally reverted back to the half shekel, which was the original law given in Exodus 30. So that's interesting there. So they paid a certain amount of money. Now this had nothing to do with their percentage of income. Everyone paid the same amount. It was rich or poor, you paid the same amount. This was not a percentage thing at all. You paid the half shekel, now here a third of a shekel. And then in verse 33, he enumerates the things that this went for when he talks about the service of God. For the showbread, for the continual meat offering, for the continual burnt offering, of the Sabbaths, of the new moons, for the set feasts, for the holy things, and for the sin offerings to make an atonement for Israel, and for all the work of the house of our God. Now in verse 34 we have another interesting thing. And we cast the lots among the priests, the Levites, and the people for the wood offering, to bring it into the house of our God, after the houses of our fathers, at times appointed year by year, to burn upon the altar of the Lord our God, as it is written in the law. Now this wood offering is an interesting thing, because we don't read about the wood offering in previous accounts of the law of Moses. But it was the job of the Nethinims, who were the servants of the temple, it was the job of the Nethinims to be the hewers of wood and the drawers of water. And in all probability, we have a very low ratio of Nethinims now of the people going back to Jerusalem. Because if you stop and think for a minute, the Nethinims were the servants of the temple. When they were carried into captivity and they lived in Babylonia and had maybe the same opportunities that any other slave had or any other captive person had, then after 70 years, they were probably on a par equal with any other captive person, and they wouldn't have near as great a desire to go back and be a servant of the temple as maybe some of the others would have. So they might have been short of Nethinims, and so in order to get the wood for the to burn upon the altar of the Lord our God, they drew lots among the priests, Levites, and the people as to who would bring in the wood offering. And that's what this verse is about. And that's interesting to note that. So they shared this duty by the drawing of lots. Verse 35, and to bring the first fruits of our ground and the first fruits of all fruit of all trees year by year under the house of the Lord. Now it seems that these lots also had to do with who would bring the first fruits in. And this could be a rather complicated thing as to how they would delegate these duties, but he just enumerates the fact of it here. In verse 36, also the firstborn of our sons and of our cattle, as it is written in the law, and the firstlings of our herds and of our flocks, to bring to the house of our God under the priests that minister in the house of our God. Now this is interesting about the firstborn of our son. This is a law found in Exodus 13, verses 1 through 15. And what it really amounts to is that all of the firstborn of the males, of the people or of the cattle, belong to God. The firstborn male belonged to God. Now, God allowed them to take their firstborn males and to redeem them. Go to the temple and make an offering and redeem them. And then he, in place of them, took the Levites for his service. And one of the things interesting about this is that this same law was in effect, of course, when our Savior was born, when Jesus was born. And we read about that in Luke, the second chapter. I'd like to turn over there and read about that. And we learn an interesting part of the history of the life of Christ. Luke 2, beginning with verse 21. And when 8 days were accomplished for the circumcising of the child, his name was called Jesus, which was also named of the angel before he was conceived in the womb. So here he was, 8 days old, when he was circumcised and the name was given. Verse 22, and when the days of her purification according to the law of Moses were accomplished, they brought him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. Now the days of her purification were 40 days. Mary had to wait 40 days before she could take him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord. So we know then when they went to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord that Jesus was at least 40 days old because she had completed the days of her purification. Now the interesting thing here is that it was after they went to Jerusalem for this time of purification, it was after that that they came back to Nazareth, to Bethlehem, and then the wise men came. And you know, the great picture in the minds of most people is that here he is on the night that he was born, laying in the manger, and here come the three wise men. Got the shepherd standing there and the three wise men and the star overhead, all while he's in the manger. Jesus was at least 6 weeks old when the wise men came. They weren't coming to celebrate his birthday because it was not his birthday. He was at least a six-week-old infant and maybe older than that. So the story has been quite distorted when you talk about the wise men. Jesus had been to Jerusalem to be presented to the Lord. Now, what they did to redeem him, they made an offering. Verse 23, as it is written in the law of the Lord, every male that openeth the womb shall be called holy to the Lord, and to offer a sacrifice according to that which is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of turtle doves or two young pigeons. So they made an offering which redeemed him and bought him back from the Lord. He originally was the Lord's, every firstborn male was. They bought him back from the Lord with this offering, and then it was followed according to the law. Now, the offering that they made varied with the wealth of the parents. Some parents who were more wealthy made a more expensive offering, and then some who couldn't afford that offering, as Joseph and Mary were, they made the offering of the turtle doves or the two young pigeons. And so this is an interesting feature too, as I understand it. And while he was there, while Jesus was there at Jerusalem on that occasion, the old prophet Simeon came and saw him, and the prophetess Anna came and saw him, and each one gave their prophecy about him. So those are interesting things. Well, that all goes back to this law here that was given in Exodus 13, and which these people now in the time of Nehemiah are reaffirming that they're going to do. The firstborn of our sons and of our cattle. Now, another thing about the cattle is, and some of the stock, for example, as I understand it, a little baby donkey, you could redeem it by giving a lamb in its place. And that way, then you could bring the donkey back and use it in the labor and not have to sacrifice it. But the laws govern these things so that the people had a very deep recognition of the fact that this firstborn belonged to God. And they had to do something to get it back from God. Otherwise, it was really... God claimed it as his. Verse 37. And that we should bring the first fruits of our dough and of our offerings and the fruit of all manner of trees, of wine and of oil unto the priests to the chambers of the house of our God. Now, they brought these, the first fruits here, of the dough. That is the, one translation says, of the kneading trough. The best that they had, the first thing they produced there, they brought of the first fruits. As I understand it, an orchard, which made its first production on the fourth year. All the produce that orchard produced in its first year went to God. They could not sell the first year's production. The first fruits went to God. And so the first fruits of the dough and our offerings and the fruit of all manner of trees, wine and oil, went to the priest to the chambers of the house of our God. Now these were stored in the chambers or the rooms of the house of our God. Another interesting thing here to me is that this word here where it says of wine and of oil, this word for wine here is the word tirosh, which according to Strong's Concordance is translated as fresh blood of the grape, unfermented. So this would really be, according to that translation, would be true grape juice that had not been fermented and was in the grape juice state. There's another word for yayin that's also used many times in the Old Testament that means wine, and it does mean the fermented, intoxicating type of wine. Now, when the Bible's talking about yayin, it says of Aaron and the priest that they are not to drink it in the tabernacle. This was not to be consumed in the tabernacle. It could be used as a pour offering. A pour offering, you take it and you pour it on the altar, but you do not drink it. Whereas this tirosh was stored in the chambers of the house of God. Now, also in the latter part of verse 37, and the tithes of our ground under the Levites, that the same Levites might have the tithes in all the cities of our tillage. Now, all the cities round about Jerusalem, in which they had tillage, that is, they had farmers who lived there and worked the ground. You know, it's only been in recent time that the farmers lived out on the farms. The farmers usually live in the little towns, and they go out to the farms to work the farms, and they come back to the towns. And so these cities, when we talk about the cities of our tillage, these would be the cultivated land around the cities. They also produce tithes. Verse 38, and the priest, the son of Aaron, shall be with the Levites when the Levites take tithes. And the Levites shall bring up the tithes of the tithes unto the house of our God, to the chambers, into the treasure house. Now he speaks of the Levites taking tithes, and he calls it the tithes of the tithes. And what that is, it is, you know, a tithe is 10%. So the tithes of the tithes is 10% of the 10%. So of all the thing that was given in the way of tithes, one-tenth of that then, which would be one-tenth of the tenth, the tithe of the tithes, was for the Levites. And they took the tithes of the tithes for their own benefit, as I understand this then. For the children of Israel and the children of Levi shall bring the offering of the corn, of the new wine, and of the oil unto the chambers, where are the vessels of the sanctuary, and the priests that minister, and the porters and the singers, and we will not forsake the house of our God. So we have the conclusion of chapter 10, and it concludes by saying, we will not forsake the house of our God. Now what this means, not to forsake the house of our God, really means that they will not forsake the keeping of the ordinances of God. Because these ordinances of God revolved around the duties involving the house of God, or the temple, the priesthood, and the exercise of the duties of the priesthood. And to neglect the house of God, to neglect the care of the priest and the duties of the priesthood, then was to actually neglect their duty to God. You just could not serve God and neglect this part of it. And so it's kind of like a person today who says, well, I'm going to serve God, and I don't have to have any church. I don't care about the church. I'm just going to serve God. You can't do that. You cannot serve God and not be involved with the church, because the church is the body of Christ. It is the organ here of which the members of God's family are a part of. Now, beginning in chapter 11, and